The challenge, I think, with purpose is a lot of times in the world, we talk about purpose with big, you know, neon letters that are blinking. You're solving world peace or you're solving world hunger. But purpose is also a sense that we matter in the day-to-day, that whatever that thing is that we do actually matters to somebody else. We will absolutely sign up for, you know, 15% annualized growth. We will be good corporate citizens or organizational citizens. But the thing that will get us out of bed in the morning is knowing how our work contributes to a real human being at the other end.
Welcome to the Work for Humans podcast. This is Dart Lindsley. Is joy too much to expect of work? Sometimes it seems like even contentment is out of reach. But after studying the sociology of work for over two decades, PhD Dr. Tracy Brower believes employees can find happiness, but she puts a lot of responsibility on employees to take an active part in co-creating their own experience of work. Yes, employers must create the right conditions, but also employees need to know how to take advantage of those conditions. Tracy is an award-winning speaker, the current VP of Workplace Insights at Steelcase, and the author of The Secret to Happiness at Work. Her publications have been translated into 16 languages and featured in Forbes, Fast Company, TEDx, The Wall Street Journal, and Fortune.com, among others. In this episode, Tracy and I discuss the multifaceted nature of agency in the workplace, including its benefits, drawbacks, and potential alternatives. We also talk about challenging common work-related myths, fostering intentional relationships, finding purpose in one's work, developing the right growth opportunities for employees, and much more. All right, to show your support for Work for Humans, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. And now, my conversation with Tracy Brower. Tracy Brower, welcome to Work for Humans.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'm super excited to have you on the show because I think that your work represents something that needs to be on the show to balance it out. And so, as you know, the hypothesis of the show is let's talk about how companies can design work better and can design it in such a way that people who experience it feel whole and alive is the way we talk about it. But that can be misunderstood. And I've gotten some feedback that it is misunderstood, which is the misunderstanding can be that the only responsible party for the experience of work is the company. And your books are entirely, and your writing are entirely about agency and about what people can do. This is a value that needs to be co-created. I wouldn't want anybody to think that the only agentic thing in the room is the company. So that's where I want to start.
I'm very much in the camp of really believing that we all have a lot of agency and we can empower ourselves. And I love your points and I absolutely believe that organizations and leaders and individuals also have the responsibility to create the conditions for great work experiences. But I really see it as a both and. So looking forward to our conversation.
Great. And what tipped me off to it is in your book, The Secrets to Happiness at Work, every chapter starts off with choose. Because the point being that there are more degrees of freedom than people think, and that they do have that agency. And so I want to talk through each of these points. So first of all, before we start, one of the things that you talk a lot about in the book is how to achieve joy at work. And I guess one of my first questions is this, is that too much to ask? That's my first question.
It's a big one. It's a good one. And I think one of the things to know is that it's really a real experience that happiness and joy ebb and flow. So when we talk about creating joy at work, it doesn't mean every day we're popping out of bed, hearing the birds singing and seeing sunshine on the horizon. We might have good days and bad days. There will be things we love about our work and things that aren't so exciting. There may be more things that are less exciting to us than more exciting, but we can have an overall sense of joy and contentment even with the ups and downs. And I think it's also really important. We have this myth of happiness in our culture that if we're not always happy every minute, we may not be doing something right. And we have a myth that it's just this sort of superficial experience. And In reality, when we have joy and happiness at work, we tend to experience things like dedication and commitment. We tend to experience things like immersion. We get immersed in our work and we lose track of time. We tend to experience things like a sense of mattering and like what we're doing really, really matters. And we tend to have a sense of vigor. We're energized by our work and we're motivated to put energy to our work. And so those are elements of joy and happiness, which I think help unpack what do we really mean by joy and how do we achieve it? And we can talk about how to achieve it, but I think those four elements are actually really helpful to be specific about.
Let's talk about agency in the world today, because it's clear from your book that you feel that people are not reaching for their agency, that they don't feel the ability to change their circumstances. And so what's at the core of that? And it's tempting to think of it as sort of an epidemic of helplessness or something. But I actually, most of the times when I go back and I read earlier books, I find out, nope, it's an old thing. It's been around a long time. So what are the sources of that?
Yeah, I feel like we have this assault on work today, this narrative about quiet quitting and all work is bad and the best situation is to do as little as possible. And I think one of the sources is that we forget that work is actually a source of esteem. Work is the way we express our talents, that we contribute to our community, that we feel like we matter. We get a lot of esteem from understanding that work is part of a full life. And of course, we all need moments to sit on the couch and relax. But there's a really important concept of eustress. Eustress being just enough stress, like a parabola curve, right? If we don't have enough stress, then we can experience being de-energized or demotivated or depressed. If we have too much stress, we experience being demotivated, de-energized, depressed. And so this idea that we need enough challenge and that work can be a source of that, I think is really important. And so we just need to remind ourselves the extent to which we're empowered to create the conditions around us. Like, we don't have to wait for everything to be just right in order to be happy or joyful. We can create conditions for happiness at work. And we can talk about how we do that. But that assault on work, that narrative around work and life being really separate rather than being parts of the whole and all of the dimensions that make us who we are and contribute to our happiness and identity are things that I think have gotten lost over time and that we need to remind ourselves about.
So I see two parts to this agency around happiness at work, one of which you were just talking about, which is that a part of being happy at work is how we see, how we perceive the good parts. And we are not as disappointed in the bad parts. There's this other part, though, about changing our environment and what we can do to change it. Do you find that there are a lot of people who do not feel the ability to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, we need to remind ourselves of our capability. I love the idea of how we see and how we perceive. Frequently, I've written about, hey, how do you create joy at work? How do leaders create the conditions for joy? How do we think about joy? And I will frequently think about mindsets and mechanics. And mindsets are the first of it, right? How we see what we aim at absolutely distinguishes what we're focused on and what we are filtering out. I think the other thing that's worth saying is I love the concept of linguistic determinism. The words we use, how we refer to things, how we frame the problem, how we frame the challenges in front of us absolutely dictate how we will see solutions. So if I frame the problem all about, oh, my company doesn't value me, my company isn't doing what I need them to do, my leader isn't this, or my leader isn't that, or my colleagues aren't measuring up, all of those actually create a sense of disempowerment among us because we've actually reduced our sense of our own ability to do anything about it. So how we see is absolutely critical. And our reminding ourselves that we can think about our purpose differently. We can build relationships because we know they're critical to happiness. We can seek happiness both inside and outside of work because we know that both of those impact on each other. Those are just examples, but we absolutely can understand that we can create the conditions for our own happiness in addition to feeling like there's some responsibility on the parts of leaders and organizations to create those conditions.
Let's talk about the perception part first. I love that phrase, linguistic determinism. I'm going to study up on that. That's a term I haven't heard before. And I see linguistic determinism in even the structure of sentences. Who is acting on what? Who's the actor and who's the acted upon? And frequently, I see people describing their environment in such a way that they are the ones being acted upon and not the actors. So I love that idea of linguistic determinism. What are some of the myths about work that run in our heads that contribute to that?
I think some of the myths that run in our head, that's a great way to think about it. One of the myths I think runs in our heads is that organizations are just trying to suck everything they can out of workers in the worst possible way. And that may be true of some organizations, but in general, I think we can remind ourselves that organizations want us to be our best. And it's actually a good thing when people are empowered to do their best because it's good for the organization as well. So I think that's one of the myths that can kind of run in the background in terms of this narrative. I think another myth is that people believe that the organization holds all the power and that if the conditions aren't right that the organization has created, then there's nothing left for them to create. That's another one I think that can get in our way. Another perception, I think, is that work and life are really separate. That myth can get in the way of us bringing more of ourselves to the workplace. And we need to be smart about how much of ourselves we bring to the workplace. And we need to be smart about our transparency. We want to retain privacy, but to the extent that we share more with our colleagues, we tend to build trust. To the extent that we tend to be more transparent about what's going on for us, we tend to build relationships. And so those are some of the things I think that matter in terms of our perception. There's a beautiful concept in sociological thinking that proximity is the number one determinant of relationship. It's not rocket science, but it is really intriguing. The people we see more, the people we have more contact with, the people who know more about us tend to be the people that we build stronger relationships with. And so actually, when we share more, we build the conditions for reciprocity and we build the conditions for collegial relationships that have meaning for others, but also for us. And the last thing I would say, just really briefly, is I think we have a myth that the organization owes us something, but we don't necessarily owe the organization anything. And I think organizations and our work are really great representations of our obligation to society. Like, if we have great skills and talents and capabilities, we actually owe something to the people around us. We have a really empowering need to make that contribution. And so showing up isn't showing up virtually, physically, figuratively, literally. Showing up isn't just something we're doing for somebody else. It's actually something we're doing for ourselves, because by fulfilling that obligation to the community, we build our esteem. We remind ourselves how we matter as a member of a community more broadly.
It's something I have said fairly recently, which is that my company is a friend of mine.
Yeah.
What that means is, well, in this particular case, it was that I saw something my company was doing that I thought was a mistake. And I had a choice to not take any risk and just not mention it or step forward and mention it. And I sat back and I thought, what should I do? And my answer was, you do what you do for a friend, which is if you see that happening, you step forward and you mention it. And so I did. And I knew that it probably wouldn't be listened to. That was a part of the fact. But that's a very different framing than my company is a competitor of mine. You talk a little bit about the myth of value. And what it is that some work is inherently more valuable than other work, and that all work has dignity. Can you expand on that a little bit?
This is absolutely core to my belief, this idea that all work has dignity. This actually came out of Martin Luther King Jr. He was speaking at a rally that was associated with a strike among trash collectors and garbage professionals and personnel picking up trash in the streets. And he said, you know, we value people in our society who are doctors and healthcare providers because they reduce the incidence of disease and they increase the incidence of health in our society. And we should value trash collectors and people who work in the garbage industry because they increase the incidence of health and reduce the incidence of disease in our society. All work has dignity. And I think we need to remind ourselves about that as individuals, as leaders, as teams, and as organizations. No matter what we're doing, we are absolutely contributing to the community overall, whatever role that is. My skills and talents might contribute slightly differently than yours or yours or yours, but all work has dignity to the extent that work is the way that we contribute to the organization, to the community. And I actually worked with an organization. It's a not-for-profit organization, and they're doing wonderful work in third world countries around vaccinating new moms and taking care of infants and contributing to better health and safety in terms of water sources, all kinds of things. Those are examples. And they talk in their workforce about how the people on the front lines are really the most valuable. Those people who are helping with infant health and helping with water supplies. And that's really less helpful for all the people who are at the home office doing what they do. And so to me, that's an example of where we need to be valuing of all the work. Yes, the person on the front line helping deliver the infant and caring for the health of the infant and the maternal and infant health. Yes. And the person who's serving lunch in the cafe to all the people at the home office, or the person doing accounts payable in the home office, or the person doing recruiting in the home office. All of those are parts of a community and parts of an effort that contribute to that whole at the end. And so I feel like that myth of value, that idea that some work is more valuable than other work, is less helpful. And we actually, when we remind ourselves about the value that we bring, when organizations remind us of our purpose and line of sight to the value that others are bringing and how we are part of that, that actually is the creation of the conditions for great work experiences.
One of the other myths that you mentioned is the myth of drudgery. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, this is the idea that, you know, work is hard and work is difficult and work is just the worst part of life. And of course, there are things in our work that are less exciting for us. I don't love doing my expense reports, but there are things that we can appreciate about our work. And one of the ways that we create the conditions for happiness is by thinking about sort of an intersection of what do I love to do and what do I have to do? And you want more intersection than less in terms of those, that Venn diagram, if you will. But it's really unusual to have perfect intersection. There'll always be parts of work that aren't so exciting. But when we think of work as an opportunity to express ourselves, to express our skills, to express our capabilities, that actually contributes to a sense of happiness. And this actually goes back to linguistic determinism, right? Oh, I have to go to work today. Oh, I have to do this thing. I have to show up in the meeting. Oh, I have to work with these people. That's a really different framing than, you know, I get to go do my best today, or I get to work with some of these people who are wonderful and eclectic, and I'm going to learn something from them. I get to be challenged today by the problem I'm going to be solving. It's a different framing in terms of believing that it's not all drudgery. And it's not about Pollyanna, and it's not about like deluding ourselves. Of course, some parts of work aren't that exciting, but it's also meaningful to go do good work, whatever kind of work that is.
I'll tell you, there's another myth. It's not on the list. You can add it maybe to the list. There's a myth that management is not workers. There's a tradition of talking about workers and talking about leaders. It's a complete myth that leaders are not workers. Leaders work their asses off. In fact, when you look at the degree to which people have sold their lives, I noticed that my own language right there is somewhat deterministic. But when you think about people who have sold their lives to their job, it's routinely the people at the top of a company who are doing that more than anybody else. It's like one of those things that there's an us and them that happens in the hierarchy of a company that leads to not having enough charity to leadership and not recognizing the challenges of that work. It's a funny thing to say. You know what it is? In comedy, it's okay to punch up, but it's not okay to punch down. But it's so okay to punch up that we are in the habit of throwing stones at people who are working really hard and doing their best with very little information.
Yes, exactly. I actually just did an article on this. I think we don't really remind ourselves enough about how hard it is to be a leader. And middle management, especially, is a very, very stressful place to be because a lot of times you're not the decision maker, but you're having to execute on the decisions. And you need to be transparent and authentic, but you also need to be smart about how you're communicating and how you're thinking about motivating. And there's some great research on empathy. When cultures are more empathetic, people tend to be more innovative. They tend to be more likely to stick around with the organization over time. They tend to perform better. They tend to have the greater experiences of learning and growth. And a lot of times we think of empathy as going sort of punching down, if you will, I suppose, like leaders are supposed to be empathetic toward employees. But the opposite is also true. When we demonstrate empathy to leaders, to middle managers, that's a very big deal. And I think what we can do, this is the agency structure conversation, right? The organization, leadership responsibility, and the individual responsibility. Again, sociologically speaking, the number one way that we learn is through watching other people, listening to other people, experiencing other people. And so we each have more influence than we think we do. That's potentially another myth, is that, oh, leaders and organizations have all the power and I lack power. We all have more influence than we realize. And so when we demonstrate empathy toward leaders, when we remind ourselves that we're all working on the same problem together, we just happen to be doing slightly different roles or tasks, I think that not only contributes to a better culture broadly, but it contributes to a better experience that we will have as well. And that's about kind of the reciprocity too, right? Like when the organization delivers on things like learning and growth and meaningful feedback and opportunities to do good work, then as an employee, we're more motivated to do that good work as well. And so that reciprocity factor, that putting ourselves onto the stage as a player, not just as a watcher or as an audience member or a receiver of the drama, we actually contribute to better conditions for our own work.
I want to mention where that article is so people can find it, the article on management. It's the March 23rd article in Forbes that's about management, and it's Middle Managers Have It Bad, is the title of your article. And in fact, it is one of the premises of this show. So people who listen to the show routinely know this, but I'll mention it again, which is years ago, I conducted a study with a team of anthropologists of management around the world. And so we went around the world and we sat with managers, we followed them, and we looked at what their challenges were, what their mental models were. And their biggest challenge was that they sat between two competing demands. They had the competing demands of the business and they had the competing demands of their teams. And they had no method, no mental model for navigating those competing demands. So what I'm recommending is that we recognize that employees are customers and form one side of a multi-sided business. So managers are brokers between the business, bringing great work to the teams and making sure that it's allocated correctly. And then the reverse, which is great teams producing work. So anyway, I completely agree with that. It's a very hard role. It's not respected enough because that's one of the most challenging things to do.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I've studied so much of leadership in general, but also in relationship to kind of work life and work life boundaries. And one of the things that leaders can tend to do is take on lots and lots of responsibility because they're trying to shield their team. They're trying to do more of the work so their team can get away. So they end up working the weekend so their team isn't. But what I have talked to leaders about and written about over time is that's actually less helpful because you're also modeling the way, even if you don't mean to be a model, you don't mean to be all that, we learn from each other. And so the choices that leaders make end up getting expanded and accentuated through the culture. And so when leaders take on all that responsibility, they actually set the stage for others to feel like they should be taking on all that responsibility. So when leaders can take care of themselves, set those boundaries, that's actually really good for the culture. Much easier said than done, though. That is a hard thing for leaders to do. So I have absolute empathy.
Yeah, I sympathize with that. I know I do that at work, which is, I don't necessarily want to shield the team from work, but I do want to shield them from risk, like career risk. It's a slightly different thing, but it ends up looking like just a lot of work. In other words, it ends up modeling the wrong thing. And it also, the stress comes totally through me and spreads if I'm not careful. So what I want to do is I want to go through, I think, for each of your chapters, and I'm going to read what your chapters are so people, we won't be able to talk about every single chapter, but for each chapter, or at least select chapters, I want to ask you what they mean. And then I want to talk about how companies might meet halfway. How might we create a platform as a company that enables that kind of agency? The ones I want to choose the most and focus on are the agency that has to do with action as opposed to perception. So you have choosing joy, and every chapter starts off with choosing. So I'm just going to say what you're choosing. Joy, purpose, culture, relationships, growth, success, alternatives, and more. I'm going to ask you, is there one of those that you would want to talk about in terms of companies meeting halfway?
Yeah, I think that talking about growth and purpose and relationships would be especially useful in terms of thinking about meeting halfway.
Great. Let's start with choosing relationships. What's that all about?
Yeah, so choosing relationships, one of the things that we know is that relationships are fundamental to our sense of happiness. Relationships inside of work, outside of work, but especially inside of work. There's some wonderful research that 75% of people make their friends at work. And 81% of people actually make their more diverse friends at work. I've written lots of articles on belonging and friendship and how work is part of that equation. So you can Google that if you feel like it. But the thing that is important in terms of this idea of both agency and structure is that we can reach out to colleagues. We can be intentional about getting to know people. We can be intentional about joining a project team where we're going to get to know new people. We can be intentional about seeking mentorship or seeking a one-on-one relationship where we have lunch with somebody or coffee with somebody or seek somebody out in the hall at the coffee machine. So that's the agency part of it. But then organizations can also meet halfway in terms of building relationships between people. So how do we maybe combine people on a project where we know there's meaningful work for each and we can get to know people through that project? How do we set up groups that allow people to get together around common interests? How do we look at maybe community or volunteer events where people can get to know each other? I always like to think about, you know, how organizations are saying, oh, we're giving free food on Wednesdays to, you know, get people in. It's not about the food, right? Well, maybe it is about the food, but it's also about we're sort of providing the opportunity to get together, right? Like free food gets us together. It gets us breaking bread together. So those are just really super pragmatic, sort of action-oriented ways that we can think about emphasizing and investing in relationships with colleagues. And organizations can also provide those opportunities for us to come together with colleagues in multiple ways.
Is there anything that we know about friend formation that might inform how we enhance that?
Yes, we know a lot about friend formation. And I've written on this topic as well. Work is a great place to make friends for a few different reasons. One of the reasons that work is a great place to make friends is because you get to know people over time. Even if you're moving jobs every 1 or 2 years, which is very trending right now, you still get to know people over time. And friendship formation is super related to continuity. I saw you then, I knew you when we went through this together, or I saw you when this happened in your life, right? So friendship formation has to do with continuity over time and getting to know people and familiarity over time. And that's why work works really well as a context for friendship. Another thing that we know about friendship formation is that it works really well when we see ebbs and flows in friendship. You were down and I helped you up. I was down, you helped me up. And when we work with people, by definition, we're going to see them on days when they're, you know, on top of the world and other days, not so much. They're struggling. And so that ebb and flow in the dynamics of work is really good for friendship. Another really good reason that work is a great place to create collegial relationships and connections is the presence of both task and relational opportunities. It's a myth that we build teams based on all the fun things that we do. We do build our relationships that way. So, you know, do your axe throwing with your team, do your virtual happy hour. All those are good things. But even more powerful are when we roll up sleeves together and do work together for a common goal. And so work gives us that opportunity. I get to be working on the project with somebody and learn about their skills and bring my skills and feel that challenge that we work through together and that appreciation together. And I got to see at the coffee machine and hear what you thought about your weekend or, you know, what's going on with you. It's that task and relationship, and that dimension in relationships is helpful. And the other thing that we know about building of friendship and relationship is that it's very based on reciprocity. Like I give you, or I share with you and you share with me, or you give back. And work is a perfect opportunity for that. You asked me for something and I got back to you in email, and then I needed something and you were able to provide it. That reciprocity and that investment over time where we are contributing together is also part of building strong relationships. So work is this great context for how we can build and feel that level of connectedness with each other.
One thing I've written is that friendship often comes out of hard times shared. The challenge there is that as a company designing, you know, something that might create friendship, that means I need to give people hard times. Luckily, those come, you don't have to design those in. Hard times are always around. But, and actually, when you think about, for instance, how the military trains Rangers, every place you go for the next 2 weeks, you're going to be carrying this telephone pole together. That's an example of a hard time shared that's completely manufactured. It's not the worst kind of hard time. It's not shame or, you know, some of the other kinds of hard times that you can have that are much harder. But what I like about what you're saying is that just throwing people together and having hard projects will have that effect. And also continuity over time will have that effect. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the thing I would add there that I just think is fascinating is if you look at the research on belonging, we don't get a sense of belonging just from being with other people. Just showing up at the party and trying to mingle is not what will give you belonging. Just being in the office in the work cafe won't necessarily give you a sense of belonging. Belonging tends to come from a shared sense of social identity and a shared sense of goals. And so that is what works well in terms of putting people on tasks together, giving them common goals. And to your point, we don't need to manufacture hard times because there'll always be the huge deadline that we have to get through together. There'll always be the challenging customer. There will always be the, oh my gosh, what are we going to do about this? It didn't go quite like we thought it was going to go. Those things will happen in the normal course of events. And so when we give ourselves challenging goals that move us forward in the market, that move our business forward, those will be the context for the belonging that can come from our good work together.
Yeah. And there's always external events that are hard.
Yes. So true.
Choosing purpose. That sounds like a little bit like it could be related to the topic that we were discussing before, which is all work is valuable. But let's expand on that a little bit. What is the thesis there, and how might we create a platform for more of that?
Yeah, this one's such a big deal. When we feel a sense of purpose in life and work in any context, we tend to experience a greater level of happiness. The challenge, I think, with purpose is a lot of times in the world, we talk about purpose with big, you know, neon letters that are blinking. Like purpose is you're solving world peace, or you're solving world hunger, or you're doing really important things. And those are true. So thank heaven for the people who are working on those things. But purpose is also a sense that we matter in the day-to-day, that the small thing that we do, whatever that thing is that we do, actually matters to somebody else. And so this is part of both the agency and the structure as well. We know organizations can motivate people more effectively when they remind us of what is it that we're doing as an organization together, when they remind us how our work matters to that thing. And we can also reinforce and validate our own contribution. You know, I am really good at managing projects. I am the person on the team who's going to bring a sense of organization, or I am the person on the team who's going to bring a sense of humor and lightheartedness, or I am the person on the team who's going to have that wacky idea that's going to take us to a new place, or I am the person who's going to show up every single day and do good work and be so reliable, right? Any of those things absolutely contribute to the community and to the team. So we can remind ourselves of our purpose and value. At the same time, the organization is helping to reinforce. I like to think of it as line of sight. How does my work connect to his work and her work and their work? And then finally, the customer. Other thing that's really important about purpose is it's feeling like there's something bigger than ourselves. It's feeling like we have a unique contribution to make to that. We've talked about those already. And it's also got to be about people. We will absolutely sign up for, you know, 15% annualized growth. We will be good corporate citizens or organizational citizens. But the thing that will get us out of bed in the morning is knowing how our work contributes to a real human being at the other end. What is the thing that we do? Maybe we work in, I don't know, the student accounts office at a university. And our work really matters to that student who's learning and figuring out where they're going to go, right? It's the personal, it's the human that is also really important to our sense of purpose. And again, that just that line of sight, right? Like I process student paperwork around their student loans, and that is the value that I bring. That's the small thing I do every day. And that really matters to a student somewhere in their experience. So that's that line of sight idea.
Yeah, I like that. I've worried that whenever we think about the least mechanistic parts of creating a work environment, we jump straight to purpose with a capital P. I agree with you. It is wrong to expect your job to be religion. That's too big an ask. It can have traceability to something that's very big. And then when I think about sort of what I'm going to call the purpose with a smaller p, which is more local and more unique. What's interesting about what you just said is that if we all share the same big purpose, then it ignores our unique contributions because that's where we get local purpose. One part of that, it seems to me that you can pay attention to, especially as a manager, is recognizing the unique value that people bring. And for instance, I had one team member who everybody who ever worked with him said in feedback, Jim is so much fun. And so that was actually the theme. Everybody wanted to work with him because he was fun. And so it was important to, I was just wanted him to know that that's what people thought. It's an example of showing people what their unique value is.
Yes, absolutely. Doing that so that other team members are recognizing it as well. I love your point about unique value and local value. And when we raise that to sort of consciousness, when we raise that to the surface, I think that's also really helpful. It kind of reminds me of the old literature on teams and the roles that were necessary in a team. And all of those roles, this gets back to all work has dignity, right? All of those roles have really important relationship to the team's success. You need the person who's going to keep you on track. You need the person with the new ideas. You need the person who's going to push the team and maybe play devil's advocate. You need the person who's going to be energizing and bring that fun, right? You can define those roles in lots of ways, but when we are recognizing and validating people individually for that, and when we are reminding the team of how each of those roles connects, that's also really helpful, I think.
Talk about choosing growth. What does that mean? And again, how can we create a platform for growth?
This is one of my favorite topics. So we tend to be happier and more engaged and more energized when we are stretching, when we're challenged, when we're trying something new. And that doesn't mean every single day we need to be, oh my gosh, trying to figure out the new thing or solve the problem that we don't have any idea how to solve. But when we have the right mixture of challenge, that is really, really related to happiness. In fact, there's a 15% rule, related to failure. When we fail 15% of the time, that seems to be optimal to keep us coming back. If we fail more than 15% of the time, we might say to ourselves, ugh, maybe this thing isn't for me. This might not be my gig. If we fail less than 15% of the time, we say to ourselves, huh, you know, I kind of have this one. I've kind of got this one going. I'm going to go on to my next challenge. And so our opportunity at work is to look for those challenging opportunities, find the problem and take the initiative to solve that thing, raise our hands for that next project or that opportunity that's slightly outside of our swim lane, put ourselves forward for that next promotion when we're most of the way ready for it and maybe not all the way ready for it, knowing that it will be a stretch challenge. And in terms of organizations meeting people part way, being really intentional about asking people, what does growth look like for them? It's not the same for everybody. It doesn't always mean sort of rising linearly in the hierarchy. Really setting up mentor relationships where people can be challenged and get feedback and think about how they are making a contribution. And giving people opportunities, not just to grow in formal classroom situations, but to have opportunities to be on a team where they're elbow to elbow and they're, you know, learning alongside colleagues who may have different skills than what they have. Organizations that set up really great feedback mechanisms that are intentional so that people can always be getting feedback about what they're doing really well and what they want to be challenged with or opportunities for continuous improvement. Cultures where we're really honest with people and we can give tough feedback that helps people improve. That's creates stretch opportunities as well. So again, I think there's this wonderful kind of both and, right? Creating stretch opportunities for ourselves and organizations creating those as well. The other thing that I always think is worth mentioning here is that, of course, our happiness inside of work affects our happiness outside of work. We kind of all know that. But the opposite is also true. When you're happier outside of work, you perceive greater happiness inside of work. So your stretch challenge might be going and building houses in the community and swinging a hammer because that's a stretch opportunity. Or your stretch opportunity might be, you know, working on the board of the mission in your city because that's an opportunity for you to take on new leadership or to contribute in ways that you don't get to contribute 8 to 5 Monday through Friday at your regular full-time employment. And when you have those stretch opportunities, wherever they're occurring, that will contribute to an overall perception of greater happiness and joy.
This is a perfect example, by the way, of the co-creation of value. A while ago, I had on the show Joe Pine, who talks about the progression of economic value from goods, commodities, goods, products, services, see if I can get this right, experience, and transformation. And the thing about transformation, which is this thing of choosing growth, is that it takes a lot of work to work on one's own transformation, one's own growth. And a couple things come to mind for me about that. One is, there's this thing, there are some people who just won't take the bait. And you provide a growth opportunity, and it's sort of like this thing of which is you can put the jellyfish at the bottom of the stairs, but you can't get the jellyfish to climb. My team, by the way, put me on a metaphor diet a while ago. They said, you only get one metaphor a day. That's all you get. And there's a different kind of learned helplessness. Ah, let's talk about learned helplessness on the other side of the table, which is, you put that sort of opportunity forward a couple of times. If people don't take it, you stop doing it. You say, oh, there's these other people who, when I put the opportunity in front of them, they grab it. And so I'm going to put more opportunities in front of them because there's somebody who are actually doing it. And if you had that a lot, I think you would stop altogether. You would keep trying. And there is a learned corporate helplessness that exists. And Jeff Pfeffer was on the show, Stanford business professor. And he talked about why HR is often called HR weenies. And he said, because HR does not take the agency it could have in many cases in terms of making a difference. And the example he gave was a chief people officer complaining about the useless benefits that people were taking. They weren't taking the best set of benefits for themselves. They weren't the best benefits for them, but it's what they wanted, or something like that. And what Pfeffer said to her is, aren't you the chief people officer? aren't you actually in charge of benefits? And so, anyway, I guess what I'm getting at is that there are more degrees of freedom that are available on every side of the equation than people give themselves credit for.
Totally. It reminds me of, we've been interviewing chief people officers lately to understand their perspectives on the work experience and creating great experiences. And prior to that, I saw a chief people officer in a webinar, and she was a chief people officer for a Fortune 50 company. And she said, if you're not at the table today, it is not going to happen. Either because your organization doesn't see the value in HR or because you aren't taking the opportunity, right? Like all paths today lead back to people, lead back to talent, lead back to employee experience. And I think about nudges, right? Like, yeah, we can put a lot of options out for people, benefits options or work options or growth options. We can just sort of put those out there. But it's more helpful if we provide those appropriate nudges. Gosh, here's where I might see you learning and growing, or here's some suggestions. It's kind of like if you go to the doctor and they lay out the options for you and you're like, oh my gosh, but I get that you want to empower me with healing options, but I'm also not the expert. So I'd love the options with a little lens on it of your expertise. And so that, again, is that middle ground of how do we give good options and how do we make sure that we are encouraging people toward them. The other thing that I think is so great, Joe Pyne is about the experience economy. Joe Pyne is about markets of one. And one of the things I think is so brilliant about that is as leaders, we have the opportunity to think about people as markets of one. This is your beautiful point about, you know, work is the product and how are we thinking about our employees as customers. But my best growth opportunities might be really different than yours. And there are so many different kinds of employees. We might have a steady Eddie who is absolutely doing great work every day, still motivated years later to be doing the great work that he's been doing all this time. And that's actually okay. And so growth opportunities in that case may not look like a new class. It may not look like a promotion. It may not look like people reporting to that person. It may look like the next challenging opportunity or the especially interesting customer that that person might be able to work with. Your point, such a great point about if you put growth opportunities in front of people and they don't take them, maybe you don't continue to offer them. Or maybe they're growth opportunities that could be better matched to what that person is valuing. Maybe they're getting tons of growth outside of the office right now, right? Like, oh my gosh, maybe they're a young parent and they're threading all the needles and doing all the things and they love what they're doing at work, but they don't need any more right at the moment. And so it's also that harmony between life and work and thinking about, all right, what does growth look like for this person at this moment with a career that we're going to value over time, knowing there will be ebbs and flows in the type of contribution they make, still high level contribution, but the type of contribution they make over time.
Yeah, it's a really important point, which is for managers, I think, which is that it's easy to sort of type people. In fact, it's very tempting. There's a billion books on how to, you know, personality types and stuff like that. But a lot of what we want from work is situational. This is the 5 years when I have preschoolers and I'm going to behave a certain way. And if you put an opportunity in front of me during that time, you know what? I'm maxed right now. But 6 years in, if you fail to put the same opportunity in front of a person, you're forgetting that, in fact, what people want from work changes.
Yes. And this is the importance of all of that open, ongoing communication, right? Like, how are we empathizing? How are we asking questions? How are we tuning in? How are we keeping that dialogue open? And I always like to think about, this is where the conversation often goes to generations and we overgeneralize, you know, all millennials are like this and all boomers are like that, heaven forbid. But really, life stage is a great proxy, right? Like when we're early life stage, want different things than when we're midlife stage or later life stage, more senior life stage. We all want similar things from work. We want a sense of purpose. We want collegiality. We want learning and growth. We want to build our social capital. We want freedom and flexibility. those will be differently sequenced based on where we are in our life stage. So we all want similar things, but we want them in different sort of priority order. So I think that's worth saying as well. And when you're a leader and you have that open relationship with your employee and you can say, hey, what does success look like for you? What does growth look like for you? What does a win look like for you right now? That may be different for every single employee. And I think a great organization, right? Like that's when you say, oh my gosh, how do I scale that? But a great organization is creating opportunities that you can then kind of match for people in the right kinds of ways.
Yeah, I get that as a response sometimes to some of my proposals, which is how do we scale markets of one?
Exactly. That's the idea of mass customization, right?
It is.
Like we've got a great mentorship program and some people may be more interested in being a mentee or a mentor or a group situation or a short term or a long term or not right now, but the system is available and then you can scale the system.
And you already have the infrastructure of scale in place. It's management. It's just a question of managers understanding their role as brokers and their role as designers, honestly, of work experience.
I love that. Managers as designers of work experience. That's beautiful. And orchestrators of the resources that are available within the organization.
Right. And so I'm going to now go into some weird little corners of agency. So one of the challenges with the whole idea of agency and, hey, anybody choose this thing, there's a potential dark side to that, which is if I'm not successful at what I'm after, I'm the only person in the room to blame because I didn't choose it. And I can tell you a very extreme example of this. My friend's mother died of cancer, and she was convinced that it was a choice, that if she'd had the right attitude, she could beat it. There are situations where it's not my fault, and there's a need to be able to recognize when that is.
Yes, so true. This is actually my chapter on choosing alternatives. I really believe like it is about doing your best. You're going to be optimistic. You're going to put as much as you can into making it work. And then you may decide that that's not possible and you need to make a different choice. And that's okay. I really, really like any good sociologist can make a 2x2 matrix, right? I really like the idea of a 2x2 with how big is the problem on the vertical and how much influence do I have on the horizontal? And I like to think about that as almost like a choice-making framework. Like if it's a little problem and I've got tons of influence, oh my gosh, I'm going to dig in. I'm going to make it happen. I'm going to find the way to influence this thing and I'm going to make that happen. And there may be situations where it's a really systemic issue and I have lots of influence and I do my best and I can't shift the culture, for example, away from toxicity or whatever the challenge is. And then I'm going to make another choice to take my influence and my skills and my contributions in other places. But for me, that framework is sort of about how hard am I going to work to make something happen here? And then how and when will I choose something different? Maybe it's a huge systemic issue and I have very little influence. I'm going to do my best for a while and then I'm going to take my ball elsewhere and go to another playground. I'm going to take my ball and find another game. So I think it's really fair that we try and we work at it and we put a lot of intentionality and best effort forward. And then it's okay to make a different choice. It kind of reminds me of, we've got two children, one graduated a few years ago and one's a junior in college right now. And it was that like, choose the best school, make your best choice. And if it's not a match, it's okay to transfer, right? Like it's, you want to keep both of those ideas in mind. Do your best, work hard, make it happen to the best of your ability. And it's absolutely okay to choose something else when it's the right time for you to do that.
And by the way, I noticed you did not have a chapter on choosing belonging.
Yes, that's my next book.
You see, that's a perfect example.
Connection, though. Relationship.
Okay, because the idea of belonging is that it is not something you're in control of. At least that's the way I read it right now. And I don't know if that's true. I don't know if it's something that can be chosen. I mean, there's actually, in your book, there's another one, which is around be optimistic. And I'm like, can I choose? Is that something I can choose or is that genetic? So I looked it up. It's largely heritable, but it's not completely heritable, optimism and pessimism. And in fact, interesting fact, they're not even sure it's one thing as a mechanism in the mind, which is that there's actually a mechanism for optimism and there's a mechanism. It's not one mechanism where you get to choose how to tune it. It's actually two different mechanisms that are both running and you get to choose which one to look at. But the other one doesn't go away when you look at the other one. So
yes, there is a heritable component to optimism and there's a choice level component to optimism. And there's some wonderful research on brain chemistry, which was related as well. The difference between dopamine and oxytocin. Dopamine tends to be your anticipatory brain chemical, like, oh, it's going to be so cool. I'm going to get this new job or, oh, this person I just met. Wow, you know, all that. That is a different experience than sort of ongoing satisfaction and happiness over time. So it's important that we're able to make that switch. In fact, there's research about romantic relationships that the romantic relationships that work best are when you're able to make the shift from, oh my gosh, this person, you know, like, wow. And then, oh my gosh, I'm going to spend 50 years with this person and kind of day to day, we're going to have coffee together in the morning. That is a different brain chemical that you're tapping into on an ongoing sense of satisfaction and happiness and contentment. And so needing both of those to be operating and then where you focus. And it has to do with work because there will be those things like, oh my gosh, I got this cool new job or, ooh, I get to work on this new project or, oh my gosh, I've really got a lot of energy happening right now because we're working through a really tough thing. And then that will come to a close and you'll just need to continue kind of making your best contribution until the next one comes up. And so it's really fair that we kind of manage the energy that we're investing over time as well. It's like the airline pilot isn't actively flying the plane every single minute. They're active on takeoff, they're active on landing, but when they're on a long flight, kind of just flying through the air, they will frequently be on autopilot. So it's really fair in our work that we're intentional about where are we putting lots and lots of energy and where are we able to back off a little bit and to be clear about that for ourselves.
I want to explore agency a little bit more. So I experience agency as a kind of aggression. I'm going to say what that means. So my team faced a challenge. We saw it as a wall. And so we came at it with a battering ram and it didn't fall down. And we said, let's climb over it. And it didn't fall down. And then we said, release the mice. We're going to crawl under it. You know, how are we going to get around it? But the truth is, to me, I did martial arts for 20 years because I like to fight. And so when I see an obstacle, it's like, ah, let's get, you know, it's like my experience of agency is it's a kind of aggression or a desire to win or something like that. Is that always the case? I never read Lean In. I never read that. I don't really know what the hypothesis was, but it seems related because that's what it feels like. That's what agency feels like. It feels like leaning in.
Yeah, I feel like, and some of the feedback and the pushback on Lean In was it was all about agency. And it was back to, if I don't have a good enough attitude, it's all my fault if the cancer diagnosis overcomes me or the cancer overcomes me, if you will. And there's absolutely a need for both agency and structure. So there's that balance between, yes, I am empowered and I can take responsibility and I have responsibility. The minute that I think of myself only as a victim, I'm exempt from responsibility because I can't affect it anyway. So now I'm exempt from responsibility. And if I don't think of myself as a victim, if I think of myself as an agent, that's more helpful to everybody, right? Because I can shift things around me that also have an impact on others. But it's not all about agency and empowerment. It's also about society has conditions and we have systemic sort of systems that drive our experience in society, in organizations, in teams, and those are also realities. So it's important, I think, that we value both agency and structure, both agency and those outside conditions. And agency is also mitigated by the rights that other people have. For me, the difference between aggression and assertion is aggression is all about me. I'm going to, you know, push and push and push, and the heck with your rights or needs or priorities or experience. If I'm an agent who is instead assertive, I'm going to push toward what I need, but I'm not going to do that at the expense of others. I'm going to find the right compromise. I'm going to find the right middle ground. If I'm in a meeting, I absolutely believe something with all my heart, and I'm going to maybe advocate for that, and I'm going to articulate that. I'm going to make my best argument. But if the team decides to go in another direction, I'm not going to storm out the door. I'm not going to refuse to participate. I'm not going to exempt myself from the next stage of the process. So yes, I've expressed agency, but I've been assertive about that in knowing that my opinion isn't the only one, nor is it probably the best one. I actually think that this relates to professional courage and humility. Like, we want to be confident. We want to express professional courage. We want to stand up and do our best. And we need to acknowledge that we aren't the only one with ideas in the room, and our perspective is necessarily limited. And we need to be thinking about what can we learn from other people and how might their experience be different. I think social media has, and media both, have pushed us to this world where we're hearing ideas and opinions that agree with our own, and we may have an outsized impact of the extent to which opinions are like ours. And we need to reach for and have a lens of, gosh, other people have different points of view and we can learn from those. We don't want to insulate ourselves from difference. We want to really reach out and seek to learn from difference. And that's part of assertiveness. You've got a different experience than I do. Let's kind of figure it out together.
I like that. I like the distinction between assertiveness and aggression. There's a sporting feeling to that aggression. It's not, you know, really wanting to hurt somebody. It is wanting to win sometimes. One of the guests I had on recently was Margaret Heffernan, and she has a whole book on how obsession with winning is the worst thing that can happen in organizations sometimes. But I can also imagine there's this other side to it, which is that I'm going to call it the agency of the gardener. Gardeners have agency, and it's the agency to, you know, put fertilizer on the plants or to prune the plants or to, but it's not about winning. It's about growing. And so there's probably a lot of different attitudes of agency.
Yeah. And I think we can absolutely have an attitude of winning. I think one of the things we need to be conscious about is where we're choosing to frame it. This is linguistic determinism again, right? Where we're choosing to frame it as winning and losing, and where we're choosing to frame it as growing. And I think sometimes that has to do with internal and external. Do I want to absolutely positively win against my competitor? Do I want to win in the market? Do I want to grow my business by winning? Absolutely, I do. And internally, if we are growing together and putting our energy toward winning against what's external and growing together internally, I think that may be more helpful. If we're fighting battles internally, if we're putting our energy toward winning and losing the agenda item or the argument in a meeting, that may not be as useful when we're trying to win externally. So I think if we're internally, if we're doing more cooperation and externally more competition, that's probably really good use of our energy and resources.
I want to ask you some of my closing questions. What job do you hire your job to do for you? So your job hires you to do something for it. What do you hire it to do for you?
I hire my job to provide me with stimulation, challenge, and belonging. I so value all that I get to learn in my work, all the people that I feel connected to, and all of the stimulation and learning that I get through new challenges.
Is there a kind of challenge that you like best?
I love trying to come up with the next new idea that will be interesting to our customers. And I really, really love the challenge of interacting with customers when we're trying to learn something together. Like, we've got to figure out where work is going. We've got to figure out the future of work. We have great ideas and research about that. How do we continue to develop that? I love that challenge together, where we don't necessarily know the answer, but together we're going to come up with it.
What does work cost you?
I don't think work costs me anything right now in this life stage. I really like what I do. I feel fulfilled by it. When we had little kids at home, work cost me a lot of energy to make the right choices about where I was going to spend my time. And I didn't always make the right choices. There were times when I worked too late. There were times when I maybe spent time on the wrong things. But in general, I think the cost was that heavy thinking about where I was going to spend my time. I really, really tried to be at every violin concert. I really, really tried to be at every soccer match. I didn't always succeed, but I think the cost was in the heavy thinking about it and orchestration and time management. And that's a cost, certainly.
Yeah, I know that one. I can get my body to the soccer game, but I can't get my brain there.
Right.
Because of work. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yeah, tracybrower.com. I work for Steelcase. I love my job there, steelcase.com. My book, The Secrets to Happiness at Work, is on Amazon, on any seller of books. You can find it there. And you can follow me on Forbes as well.
I got to say, Steelcase is a super interesting company. It could just be a furniture company, and it's not at all. It's constantly doing research into the experience of work. I really admire that.
Yeah, I love this organization. We've done research for so many years. So now is such an interesting time to think about work and work experience and how we create great experiences for people in lots of different types of work environments and work experiences. And the cool thing is that we've been doing this research for so long that we can look over time and say, oh my goodness, this is how it's changed. Wow, these are some of the things that continue to be true. The opportunity to create work experiences impacts on companies in so many different ways, organizations in so many different ways across so many different departments. And it has such a huge impact on people, all the time that we spend at work, you know, how much work influences the best of our experiences everywhere. And so it's really influential and it's an amazing culture. We're not perfect. No organization is perfect, but it's really, really an amazing culture with some terrific people and leaders and experiences and priorities. So pretty cool.
Has Steelcase ever put together the collected Steelcase studies as a book?
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful work? It's all available online. I mean, even the things that are older, but you're right. Wouldn't it be cool if we could have a compendium of all of the work? That would be amazing.
When you do, I'll have you on the show and we can talk about it. Thank you very much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the discussion.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Work for Humans. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts and share the show with one person you think would get value from it. Believe it or not, this really helps us grow the show and reach more people who want to build the kind of work that people really want. As always, thank you to my producer, Jason Ames at Ninth Path Audio, for his insights into content and his high standard for quality. Final note, the opinions shared here are my own and not the views of Google or Cisco Systems. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.